You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to continue with our expose of the Anti-Defamation League. This will be the second hour in this second live broadcast series. You can remember, if you are a long-time listener, that we did something similar to this months ago. And a lot of this information you're hearing in this series is new. Was not included in the last one. So, get your pen and paper ready, and don't go away. I bet you didn't know that post-World War II, the Anti-Defamation League was on the United States watch list. Watch list, you say? You don't even know what that is, do you? The Anti-Defamation League links to the Bolshevik regime and its intelligence services date back decades. Even during World War II, folks, when the Soviet Union and the United States were allied against the Nazis, certain ADL officials were kept on United States military intelligence watch lists as suspected Soviet agents. According to one eyewitness account, Sanford Griffith, who headed the equivalent of the fact-finding division during and immediately following World War II, was on just such a list. The April 5, 1955 issue of Headlines and What's Behind Them catalogued a controversial instance in which the Anti-Defamation League provided cover for a known Soviet intelligence asset. The Soviet agent in question, Vladimir Stepankowski, had been deported from France and Switzerland in the mid-1930s after having been identified as the head of the Bolshevik Information Bureau, only to emigrate to the United States and immediately go to work for the Anti-Defamation League's Mitchell Solomon. Through Solomon's ties to United States Army Lieutenant Colonel Eugene Prince, an intelligence officer in charge of immigration background checks, Stepankowski was able to penetrate American wartime intelligence operations. In 1954, he was identified by Elizabeth Bentley as a member of a Soviet spy ring. However, he was saved from prosecution through the intervention of his ADL case officer, Mitchell Solomon. By this point, the ADL had deployed the Soviet agent into the National Renaissance Party of Robert Madole, a neo-Nazi counter-gang that had been set up largely by ADL infiltrators in order to create the specter of a new fascist menace inside the United States. According to the Headlines account, the Madole group attracted a small core of members principally on the basis of the ADL providing NRP founder Madole with a stable of prostitutes from the Mickey Jelke vice ring. ADL officials Ben Epstein and Arnold Forster then reportedly used Stepankowski's information to inundate the Veld Commission. That's the House Un-American Activities Committee. Remember, I told you, Joseph McCarthy was right. They inundated the committee with scare stories that the NRP had swelled to 200 to 700 members in New York City alone. ADL officials and the Anti-Defamation League as an organization are guilty of the same crimes for which Carl Spitz Chanel and Richard Miller were indicted during the 1987 Iran-Contra probe, illegally using private, tax-exempt organizations to conduct covert operations. However, unlike Chanel and Miller, who were low-level flunkies in the overall secret parallel government plot, the ADL was deeply involved in every facet of the Iran-Contra scandal and the Project Democracy scheme at the very highest levels, on both the government and private sector sides. The ADL's central role in the official Project Democracy apparatus of the Reagan-Bush era was an outgrowth of the ADL's long-standing position as a major agency within the United States branch of the Socialist Internationale, which has always been dominated by members of the old Bucharinite right opposition to Stalin. This link is typified by fact-finding division head Erwin Sewell, who was trained by the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union of former United States Communist Party Chairman J. Lovestone. Sewell was later schooled at the premier Fabian Labor School, Ruskin College, at Britain's Oxford University, William Clinton's alma mater, and then passed through the Socialist Party and the Jewish Labor Committee before graduating to his ADL post in 1967. Today, Sewell sits on the board of the League for Industrial Democracy and the Social Democrats USA. The direct links between the ADL and the Iran-Contra fiasco run through the following key players. Take note. Carl Gershman, a former paid staffer of the Anti-Defamation League's fact-finding division, was the director of the National Endowment for Democracy, or NED, throughout the Iran-Contra fiasco. From 1966 to 1972, Gershman was employed by the research department of the ADL. According to Jerome Baxt, his supervisor at the time, Gershman used his extensive experiments as a New Left activist at Yale University to provide the ADL with detailed dossiers on Students for a Democratic Society, the Black Panther Party, and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. According to documents, ladies and gentlemen, procured under the Freedom of Information Act, as well as a recently published book-length account of the FBI's COINTELPRO efforts against the black student movement in the 1960s, the ADL dossiers, apparently including Gershman's work, were regularly passed on to the Federal Bureau of Investigations, Division 5. Early this year, Gershman hired ADL Fact-Finding Division Deputy Director David Lowe as his executive assistant at the State Department United States Information Agency Unit. NED was a major government funding conduit for Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North and for the White House Deputy Walter Raymond's Public Diplomacy Project, a black propaganda and active measures effort launched to shape media coverage of the Sandinista regime in Nicaragua. Anti-Defamation League Latin American Affairs Director Rabbi Morton M. Rosenthal was directly financed by the NED in 1985 to conduct an electoral fact-finding trip through Central America. Among Rosenthal's assignments for the NED was the monitoring of the presidential elections in El Salvador. On May 23, 1983, Rosenthal issued a report charging that the Sandinista regime in Nicaragua was guilty of anti-Semitism. The Rosenthal attack on the Sandinistas was part of an effort to marshal Jewish support for the Reagan administration's Contra effort. That month, Rosenthal addressed a closed-door White House meeting sponsored by Faith Whittlesley, at which aspects of the covert Contra support program were apparently discussed. In a memorandum to the Latin American Affairs Committee of the ADL, dated June 9, 1983, Rosenthal described the ADL's direct role in the anti-Sandinista propaganda offensive. The ADL's Sandinista anti-Semitism story's unusually wide international and domestic coverage by both print and electronic media stimulated a flood of calls and mail to Nicaragua's embassy and consulates, and also elicited strong comments from members of Congress. A few days after the story broke, folks, the Nicaraguan embassy contacted us through intermediaries and inquired if we were willing to meet and discuss the issues. The embassy then called officially to invite ADL representatives to meet the Nicaraguan ambassador, Antonio Yarpin, and the meeting was held at the Nicaraguan embassy in Washington on Monday, June the 6th. Kenneth Bailton, then the national chairman of the ADL, was the attorney for Saudi billionaire Adnan Khashoggi during 1984 and 1985, when Khashoggi provided the initial funds through which the Iranian government purchased arms from the North Secord Hakim Enterprise. At the time of these transactions, Bailton was also a member of an administrative commission revamping United States federal codes. Another member of the commission was C. Boyden Gray, the general counsel to Vice President George Bush, who formerly ran the administration's Special Situation Group, Crisis Pre-Planning Group, the White House interagency units set up under National Security Decision Directive No. 3 to oversee the Reagan-Bush government's Central American policy. The Lake Resources Front Company in Geneva, Switzerland, through which General Richard Secord and Albert Hakim laundered the Iranian profits to the Contras, was controlled from the outset by attorney Willard Zucker, a former partner of Bailton's at Wilkie Farr. Zucker had been installed by the ADL national chairman in 1972 as the chief of the IOS legal department. This made him a key inside player in the Vesco looting of the fund. Edmund Safra, one of the ADL's major financial angels, was the co-owner with Willard Zucker of the fleet of corporate jets which were used to shuttle then National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane and Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North to secret meetings in Tehran. The Anti-Defamation League itself was directly involved in the Active Measures Department of the Enterprise, though its sponsorship of a series of propaganda broadsides attacking as anti-Semites leftist groups which opposed the administration's Central American policy. One such study, commissioned by the ADL in 1983, resulted in a book-length attack by writer Harvey Clare on the group called Clergy and Laity Concerned. Another study by longtime ADL stringer Rael Jean Isaac made similar attacks against the Institute for Policy Studies. In 1984, ADL chapters around the country hosted a speaking tour by Isaac. Both Clare and Isaac were funded during the same period by the Smith Richardson Foundation, a North Carolina-based tax-exempt foundation with very strong ties to the Social Democratic wing of the United States intelligence community. Reagan-era National Security Advisor Richard Allen and the United Nations Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick both currently sit on the board of Smith Richardson. This report, ladies and gentlemen, is taken tonight from the pages of Dope Incorporated. That's Dope Incorporated, researched and compiled by the editors of the Executive Intelligence Review, research done by the Citizens Agency for Joint Intelligence and the Intelligence Service. Today, more than ever, the Anti-Defamation League as an organization represents a major agent provocateur factor within the United States, fomenting racial and ethnic tensions, all the while claiming to be the great defenders of civil rights. Freedom of Information Act records show that the ADL played a major role in the Federal Bureau of Investigation's COINTELPRO Racial Matters, and White Hate Groups operations targeting the civil rights movement as well as its opponents. Among the paid informants used by the ADL during the civil rights struggles of the 1960s were Ku Klux Klan members implicated in the murders of three civil rights workers in the state of Mississippi. A February 13, 1970 article in the Los Angeles Times by investigative reporter Jack Nelson first revealed FBI and ADL joint patronage of the Roberts brothers in the June 30, 1968 murder of a Klanswoman named Kathy Ainsworth. At the time of the shootout in front of the Meridian, Mississippi home of ADL official Meyer Davidson, which resulted in the death of Ainsworth and the near death of her associate, Thomas A. Terrence III, who survived over 70 shotgun, rifle, and pistol wounds, miraculously. Alton Wayne Roberts and six other Klansmen had already been convicted for federal civil rights violations in connection with their infamous murder of civil rights workers Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner in Philadelphia, Mississippi in 1964. Roberts' case, ladies and gentlemen, was under appeal when, according to various newspaper accounts and local police reports, the brothers were approached by Adolph Sam Botnick, who is still the ADL's regional director in New Orleans, with the proposition that they would be paid $69,000 to act as agents provocateurs in setting up a Klan bombing of Anti-Defamation League official Meyer Davidson's home. In other words, the ADL hired Klansmen to bomb their own official's home. Botnick had been a close associate of the FBI Division 5, counterintelligence chief in New Orleans, the late Guy Bannister, implicated in the John F. Kennedy assassination, in whose home, ladies and gentlemen, was found stone phalluses, who had established the left-wing Fair Play for Cuba group that was part of the milieu of President John F. Kennedy's purported assassination of Lee Harvey Oswald. Bannister had also been a controller of an agent provocateur network in the Minutemen, which, according to one well-informed United States intelligence source, helped break James Earl Ray out of prison so that he could be used as a similar patsy in the April 4, 1968 murder of Dr. Martin Luther King in Memphis, Tennessee, just a few weeks prior to the Meridian, Mississippi shootout staged by the Roberts brothers at the behest of the ADL and the FBI. A police file report dated June 10, 1968, by Detective Luke Scarborough confirms the Los Angeles Times report of the Ainsworth setup, namely, that there was a three-way deal between the ADL, FBI, and local police in the matter, for which the ADL had provided all of the money. As the apparent result of such Anti-Defamation League, Federal Bureau of Investigation cooperation, much like the Waco massacre, the federal government trod lightly in punishing Alton Wayne Roberts for his part in the murder of Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney, when on March 17, 1970, he was sentenced to only 10 years and was paroled in only 3. The Roberts brothers were reportedly later given the status of federally protected witnesses and remain on the FBI and ADL's informant roster to this day. As for the ADL officials, Sam Botnick still runs the ADL's New Orleans regional office, and his then-assistant, Richard Lobenthal, took over ADL operations in Detroit. Lobenthal was later caught funding local members of the Communist Labor Party, a violent Maoist group infiltrated into local auto plants. Justin J. Fenger, who ran the ADL's Atlanta-based Southern Legal Department during the heyday of civil rights activities and Klan murders, is now Associate National Director of the Anti-Defamation League. The ADL dirty tricks, in collusion with the FBI, were later run against segments of the anti-war movement during the late 1960s and early 1970s. Freedom of Information Act documents released by the FBI, CF 100-530-X, from the special agent in charge, Los Angeles, to FBI Director Hoover on the subject, entitled Black Panther Party, Racial Matters, points to ADL-FBI collusion against the Black Panther Party as well. The document in question is an October 22, 1968 ADL report on the Black Panther Party by Carl Gershman and Jerome Baxt, which concludes, and I quote, "For the present at least, increasingly frequent and increasingly violent encounters can be expected between the Panthers and the police," end quote. The discovery of this inflammatory report in FBI files corroborates a passage in the recent book entitled Racial Matters by Kenneth O'Reilly, and a chapter titled The Only Good Panther, which says, quote, "Division 5 tried to disrupt the Panthers by manipulating Rabbi Meir Kahane and the vigilante-type Jewish Defense League, JDL, leaking information to college administrators and sources in the Anti-Defamation League, and working with newspaper columnists. The FBI compared Panther ideology with the traditional anti-Semitism of organizations like the American Nazi Party and the even more traditional anti-Semitism of the late Adolf Hitler. And in the case of the JDL, the FBI did not limit itself to the furnishing of factual information, because Kahane's group could not be motivated to act unless the information concerning anti-Semitism and other matters were furnished with some embellishment," end quote. The ADL, ladies and gentlemen, has continued its involvement in such COINTELPRO type operations to this very day. In fact, well-informed United States intelligence sources charged that after the scope of the FBI's criminality in COINTELPRO had been exposed and condemned by the United States Congress, the FBI temporarily chopped out all such COINTELPRO operations to the Anti-Defamation League. And I'm going to give you two examples of just such cases. James R. Rosenberg, also known as Jimmy Mitchell, Jimmy Anderson, is a full-time paid agent of Anti-Defamation League Fact-Finding Division. Police reports corroborate statements to the Executive Intelligence Review that Rosenberg was the Anti-Defamation League's infiltrator into the Ku Klux Klan chapter in Trenton, New Jersey, who sought to provoke the group into bombing Trenton's chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP. Pay stubs from the ADL to Rosenberg at this time have been recovered. Like many provocateurs employed by both the ADL and the more overtly violent Jewish Defense League, Rosenberg was given military training in Israel as an Israeli Defense Forces soldier on loan from the U.S. National Guard. David Koresh spent time in Israel, studied in an Israeli school, the Talmud. He was also trained by the Jewish Defense League, or the Jewish Defense Forces, in infantry tactics. In 1981, a female Jewish Defense League member, using the code name Ricky, told the Executive Intelligence Review, quote, "I met Jimmy in Israel around 1978 when I was at the Kfar Saba kibbutz near the West Bank. He was always bragging about how he worked for the Anti-Defamation League to infiltrate the Ku Klux Klan. Jimmy got all messed up on Valium. He even had to go for drug treatment, and that upset him because he got impotent for about 6 months. Jimmy really wanted to be in the Israeli military, and he made it. He sent me a picture. But he's a jobnik, a paper pusher. They wouldn't trust him in combat," end quote. Rosenberg returned from Israel in 1979 to continue his work for Irwin Sewell, who apparently used Jimmy's new military training to have him infiltrate the paramilitary right, which had become a major target of the ADL. On December 7, 1981, Rosenberg appeared in his undercover capacity on a WCCO television documentary in Minneapolis titled Armies of the Right. where he made the most violent and anti-Semitic statements of any of the members of the Christian Patriots Defense League on the show. And he himself was an operative of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, the Jewish arm of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry Southern Jurisdiction. Either by oversight or intent, the producers never identified Rosenberg as an ADL provocateur, even though they knew. They simply identified him as Jimmy Anderson, an official of the Queens, New York chapter of the Christian Defense League. Rosenberg and another ADL infiltrator, provocateur in the group, were later arrested on the roof of a Manhattan brownstone brandishing automatic weapons. Mordecai Levy, also known as James Gutman, James Frank, Mark Levine, Mark Levy, Morty, etc. On August 10, 1989, Mordecai Levy was apprehended by the New York Police Department after he mounted the roof of his 6 Bleecker Street apartment building in Greenwich Village and wounded an innocent passerby in wild sniper fire. The shooting occurred after Jewish Defense League JDL leader Irv Rubin tried to deliver a subpoena to Levy. Levy now heads the rival Jewish Defense Organization for a civil libel case. The arrest, ladies and gentlemen, of the 30-year-old terrorist on charges of attempted murder, first-degree assault, and reckless endangerment brought to light a new chapter in the pattern of FBI and ADL collusion in domestic terrorism reminiscent of COINTELPRO. In a July 18, 1984 court deposition, the Anti-Defamation League's Irwin Sewell admitted that he has met and has had telephone conversations with Levy from time to time for quite some time. Sewell's admission drastically underplayed Levy's long-standing role as one of the ADL's agents provocateurs. But in an interview with Village Voice reporter Robert Friedman, another ADL fact-finding division official, Gail Gans, confirmed Levy's status as an ADL operator. Levy was, in fact, a shared asset of the ADL, the FBI, and many other police agencies. 2 of Levy's FBI controllers are known to be FBI special agents, Joseph Valaket and Paul Locke, both of the New York field office. Freedom of Information Act documents show that the New York field office had an official liaison with the ADL's national headquarters since, at the very least, the 1960s. In February 1979, Levy was caught attempting to provoke a major riot in Philadelphia.
Red as the bloom goes, eyes beneath the ground. You are the darling of my heart. Stay till the sun goes down. Shady Grove, my little love. Shady Grove, I know. Shady Grove, my little love. Bound for the Shady Apples in the fall. I can't have the gal I love. I'll have no gal at all. Shady Grove, my little love. Shady Grove, I know. Shady Grove, my little love. Down for Shady Grove. Shady Grove, I know. Shady Grove, my love. Down for the potato.
Mind-boggling, isn't it? When you heard me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that this is the age of lies and deception, you haven't got the faintest idea in your wildest imagination. If you knew what I knew, you'd be hiding somewhere in the deepest, deepest underground shelter that you could possibly find, or you'd be right up here on the front lines fighting this battle with me. There is no place that you can look or that you can turn to trust in this day. There will be terrible confrontations in the near future as more and more people begin to realize how we've been lied to, manipulated, cheated, robbed. Our children have been sent off to fight wars in god-awful places, supposedly in the best interest of the United States of America, but in reality filling the agendas of people like the ADL. Times are going to get tough. They're going to get hard. They're going to try your very soul. One of the ways that you're going to have to prepare to meet these challenges is by protecting at least a part of whatever wealth you have, whether it's just a very small fortune or a very large one. And yes, there are small fortunes, folks. I can remember one time in my life when $5 was an awful lot of money to me. Those who do not prepare may not survive. And I'm not pulling your leg, and I'm not trying to scare you. I'm trying to prepare you, because what I'm telling you is absolutely true. Our sponsor, Swiss America Trading, can help you. But they can't help you if you don't call them. They have several different plans that you might be interested in. They're also very creative. If you have a special situation, you can work with them to take care of your particular needs. If you have a plan that you want to implement and you're not particularly interested in hearing their recommendations, they will also work with you to make your plan become a reality. They're good people. They're honest. They're the only ones I know of a buyback program. They're also the only ones I know record every conversation that you make with them so that there is no misunderstanding. And so that recording will reveal if their people misrepresented or if you misrepresented. You see, they've made it impossible for them to cheat you because they don't want to cheat you. And it's also possible that a very zealous salesperson, eager to earn a commission, could stretch the truth just a little bit. They made that impossible at Swiss America Trading. Everything's on tape. Everything is recorded. It's absolutely impossible, folks. And not only that, but you have my personal guarantee that if you feel that the slightest thing in your dealings with Swiss America Trading was not right, I don't care what it is, if you let me know, I'll get with Craig Smith, who's become a very good friend, and he's an honest, very good man. I've seen him do flip-flops and bend over backwards to make people happy. I'll get with him, and I guarantee you it'll be straightened out. And if it can't be straightened out, you'll get every penny of your money back. Now, you can't get that from anybody else. I don't care. How hard you look or how far and wide you look, you cannot find that kind of a situation. The precious metals in their various forms have been the only commodity throughout the history of the world that's ever maintained its value no matter what has happened with the economies, whether they fluctuated up or down or just flat disappeared. And today you can buy the exact same numbers of loaves of bread with 1 ounce of gold or 1 ounce of silver that you could in 1850 or 1750 or 1650 or in 300 B.C., give or take two or three loaves. So call now 1-800-289-2646 and protect some of what you have. Now, I'm not giving you a means to get rich quick, and I'm not telling you you're going to make any profit. I'm telling you you're going to protect what you have. If you make a profit, that's fine. But that's not the purpose of our accepting Swiss America Trading as a sponsor, nor is it the purpose of their sponsoring this broadcast. They stick with this broadcast because they care about the message that's delivered over these airwaves through the hour of the time. And they know that they can help you prepare for what's coming. And I also know that they can help you. I've investigated them. I've worked with them. And I know that they're probably the best, most honest sponsor that we could ever have, and who can help you in one of the areas in which you need to prepare. We also have Tim on here from Surplus and Stuff because he can help you in another area. We also went out of our way to carry food storage items, knowing that you would need those things also. And in one memorable recent period, we gave them to you. Literally gave them to you. So if you doubt our sincerity, folks, look at our record. And if you want to be one of the survivors in the coming tribulations, call Swiss America Trading right now, 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. Do it, folks, and do it now. You know that you tend to procrastinate, as we all do. Get that burden off your shoulders. You'll feel a whole lot better. 1-800-289-2646. Folks, back to the ugly, stinking, rotten, putrid truth of the ADL. Something, many things, that most of you have never dreamed possible in your wildest imagination. In February 1979, Mordecai Levy, also known as James Gutman, James Frank, Mark Levine, Mark Levy, Morty, etc., was caught attempting to provoke a major riot in Philadelphia. Using the pseudonym James Gutman, Levy obtained a rally permit for a neo-Nazi rally, at which he planned to display banners reading
quote, "Hitler was right, gas the commie Jews," end quote. Working out of the Philadelphia offices of the JDL, Levy, under his phony neo-Nazi cover, was in the process of contacting all of the local Ku Klux Klan and Nazi groups to draw them into the event. Simultaneously, he was working with local left-wing and Jewish groups and black churches to organize a counter-demonstration. When some local reporters learned of Levy's scheme and informed the National Park Service, the rally permit was canceled. Local press headlines exposed the plot with headlines such as in the journal, quote, "Jew applied for the permit for Nazi rally," end quote, and the Philadelphia Bulletin, quote, "Nazi rally rouser really Jewish," end quote. At the same time, the Anti-Defamation League ordered Levy to conduct a harassment campaign against associates of Lyndon LaRouche, which involved scores of death threats phoned into the offices of campaigner publications in New York City. By Levy's own admission, that effort culminated in an attempted JDL armed assault against Lyndon LaRouche's Riverdale, New York apartment and a menacing demonstration of JDLers and Yippies, which is the Youth International Party, in front of the campaigner offices. The ADL's direct use of Levy in criminal activities came to light in an affidavit submitted in October 1984 during LaRouche's civil libel suit against the National Broadcasting Corporation and the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith in the United States District Court in Alexandria, Virginia. Levy admitted to a California LaRouche associate that he had been ordered by the ADL to launch a telephone harassment campaign against the Alexandria jurors, which would be blamed on followers of LaRouche. The Anti-Defamation League, according to the affidavit, provided Levy with the names and addresses of the jurors. FBI Special Agent Richard Wade of the Alexandria Field Office was ordered by Federal Judge James Kacharis to investigate the Levy jury tampering evidence, but the investigation was quashed. On November 20, 1984, Levy fired a .45 caliber bullet into the Los Angeles house of a LaRouche associate who was investigating this jury tampering incident. In 1985, Levy also emerged as a suspected accomplice in several of the most significant domestic terrorist acts in years. On August 15, 1985, Shirim Subzokov, a leader of the Circassian Muslim community in Paterson, New Jersey, was the target of a bombing of his home, which caused his death on September 7th. Just days before the explosion, Mordecai Levy had been in Paterson publicly attacking Subzokov in a local synagogue with the very same charges by which the United States Justice Department's official Office of Special Investigations had unsuccessfully tried to prove Subzokov was a Nazi war criminal. A few days after the bombing, Levy held a press conference in Paterson applauding the attack, but denying responsibility. 1 week prior to the bombing, Levy had phoned a death threat to Subzokov's attorney in the OSI case, Michael Dennis Esquire, during which Levy also vowed to kill Subzokov. On October the 11th, 1985, Alex Oda, the Santa Ana, California head of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, died at precisely 11:21 a.m. after a bomb rigged to the door of his office exploded as Oda was reporting for work. The night before he was assassinated, Oda had been interviewed on two national television shows on the hijacking of the Achille LaRue cruise ship, which Oda said had been the work of an anti-Arafat terrorist splinter group from the Palestine Liberation Organization. Highly reliable sources report that Oda had been the recipient of multiple threats from Mordecai Levy, the JDL, and the JDO. Although FBI Director William Webster, a longtime friend of the Anti-Defamation League, was obliged to publicly identify the Jewish Underground as the most active terrorist organization in the United States during 1985, no arrests were ever made in either the Subzokov or Oda cases. Now, let me say that once again, just in case it didn't sink in. Federal Bureau of Investigation Director William Webster, who was a longtime friend of the Anti-Defamation League, was forced to publicly identify the Jewish Underground as the most active terrorist organization in the United States during 1985. Sources close to the late Alex Oda were candidly told by the Federal Bureau of Investigation that there would be no arrests because of the killer's links to Israeli intelligence, the Mossad. The sources were also told that Levy would not be prosecuted despite evidence of his complicity before the fact, because he was to be used by the government as a witness in upcoming federal trials of Lyndon LaRouche. Top officials of the Anti-Defamation League are suspected accessories in a number of major international political assassinations, including the murders of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme and Indian Prime Minister Indira Gandhi. While no evidence is known to exist linking the ADL to the actual executions, very strong evidence does exist in all three cases implicating top Anti-Defamation League officials in the preparation or the cover-up of those crimes. In the case of the assassination of Indira Gandhi on October the 31st, 1984, eyewitness accounts of a courtroom encounter with Anti-Defamation League officials Irwin Sewell and Barbara Wall just hours after Mrs. Gandhi was murdered by a Sikh fanatic who was a member of her own security detail report that the two were visibly elated over her assassination. The key link between the Anti-Defamation League and the Sikh extremists who murdered Prime Minister Gandhi runs through Rabbi Rosenthal, a senior ADL employee and head of the League's Latin American Affairs Division, who is directly linked to the man who ordered the assassination, Dr. Jagjit Singh Chauhan. It also runs through Rosenthal's longtime intimate political collaborator and sometimes business partner, John Speller. Speller, ladies and gentlemen, is widely believed to be a high-level intelligence agent for British intelligence and Scottish Rite Freemasonic networks associated with Lord Nicholas Bethel and Julian Amory, although he also had documented links to Israeli, Soviet, and American intelligence services. 1 year before Mrs. Gandhi's assassination, Speller sponsored a United States visit by Jagjit Singh Chauhan, which included meetings with conservative members of the United States Senate. It was partly on the basis of that American tour that Soviet news agencies blamed the Reagan administration for the Gandhi assassination, even though then-Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger was in the process of deepening United States-Indian military cooperation, which was threatening Soviet influence in the subcontinent. After Mrs. Gandhi's death, Rabbi Rosenthal and Speller, operating through a front company they had jointly established called Trans Global Resources, arranged a series of secret meetings in Washington, London, and Quito, Ecuador, which resulted in the Ecuadorian government offering Chauhan a large tract of land on which to establish a Khalistani home as the ADL's full-time director of Latin American affairs. Rosenthal had utilized the agency's channels inside the Ecuador to help establish a safe haven for Sikh extremists, some of whom had recently blown up an Air Canada flight and had plotted the assassination of Mrs. Gandhi's son and successor, Rajiv Gandhi, during a state visit to Washington in December 1984. The Sikh extremists have never tried to hide their intention of eliminating Mrs. Gandhi. Jagjit Singh Chauhan, the president in exile of the non-existent separatist state of Khalistan, issued his widely publicized call for Mrs. Gandhi's assassination on June 9, 1984, 3 days after Indian Army troops had stormed the Golden Temple in Amritsar and liberated it from the hands of armed Sikh radicals linked to Cauhan. Less than 1 week before Mrs. Gandhi's murder, Cauhan had told a caller into his Reading, England headquarters, quote, "Some man will come forward and take off the head of Mrs. Gandhi," end quote. Cauhan's call led immediately to the formation of the terrorist World Sikh Organization. Representatives of the World Sikh Organization were soon meeting with officials of the Anti-Defamation League's Interfaith Affairs Department, according to Rabbi Leon Klinicki, the department's director. The meeting had been set up at the request of Landrum Bowling, the chairman of the Eli Lilly Endowment, which heavily funds the league's interfaith unit. Surjit Singh, a top official of the World Sikh Organization, who has been intimately linked to Cauhan since 1947, is also a close personal friend of Anti-Defamation League Honorary National Chairman Kenneth Baelkin. We will continue with this next week, ladies and gentlemen. And I don't know how much of it will be live. And you may hear some reruns next week because I have to go on a trip. But if your eyes are beginning to be opened, if you're beginning to have an inkling of understanding of the lies and the deception and the way that all of us have been manipulated, Orientals, Jews, Blacks, American Indians, Caucasians, different religious organizations, churches, congregations, and yes, folks, even nations. Listen to everyone. Read everything that you can lay your hands on. But if you are really intelligent, if you want to be a real people and not a sheeple, you will never believe any of it, not one single word, including what you hear on this broadcast, unless you yourself can validate it with facts in your own investigations. And if you're too lazy to do that, or if you're unwilling to do that, or if you're in some situation where you cannot do that, then it's best that you just never believe anything at all. For to believe one word without validation is to place yourself in the control of the person who uttered that word. In effect, you become his or her puppet. And when they pull the strings, you will dance. As all puppets dance when the puppeteer pulls the strings. Read Pinocchio again. Read it again. It's about a dummy that grew up. That's right, folks. Walt Disney was an initiate of the Illuminati. He's been pulling your strings all your life. Pinocchio represented the sheeple. Pinocchio, unlike most sheeple, became a real boy who could think and who became worthwhile. How about you? Are you going to stay a wooden head all your life? A bunch of sticks and string and glue and paint? Or are you going to become a real person? Good night, ladies and gentlemen, and God bless you all. Thank you. I know, folks, that I said I would continue this next week. Take that back. We'll continue this tomorrow night. You see, even I can sometimes have a wooden head. Don't miss the hour of the time. Tomorrow, Friday night. Or any night, for that matter.